Welcome to God Talk, a show where a rocket scientist and a medical doctor, who is also my pastor, discuss science and religion. I'm your host, Doug Thorpe, and with me as always is my co-host, Dr. Andy Wyatt. Today on God Talk, we welcome our guest, Dr. Robert Marks Jr., who is a PhD. So he's going to talk to us today about the introduction to evolutionary informatics. And he's from a professor of engineering from Baylor University. So let's get started. Dr. Andy, welcome to the show.
Doug, I've been working my way through Dr. Mark's book on evolutionary informatics. And it's quite a difficult book because it's got so much math in it. But I thought this would be a perfect topic, really just apropos for God Talk, because he's going to talk about the separation of church and state as it relates to education. More importantly, specifically, he's going to talk about his study, his academic pursuit through modeling using engineering and math and computers to model the process of evolution. And he's got something very important to tell us about that, that will relate to intelligent design and the theory of evolution. But first of all, that music that was playing there, you know, that was my band. that was me playing guitar. I wasn't singing on that.
Well, I think anybody else would know that was Pink Floyd.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't play with him for very long. So just a few. Well, I think there was just one album that I did.
Well, you were a bass player.
I was a bass player. I was a guitar player, bass player, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't actually play with Pink Floyd. But that was Pink Floyd.
And
we used to play Pink Floyd, though. Well, we used to play their songs.
That was called Talk to Me.
That was Talk to Me, yeah.
Yeah, from their album, I think, Echoes. And in there, there is Stephen Hawking, our atheist friend, Dr.
Stephen Hawking was talking during that.
He was talking in that, saying that for millions of years, the human animal went along perfectly fine, and all of a sudden, it began to talk.
It's like something happened.
And it's absolutely remarkable that if you study the human evolution, you look at them and says, well, what happened here? Why did it change so much? They started to talk.
Yeah, something happened.
Something happened,
there
yeah.
was a jump between the caveman or the Cro-Magnon man or Neanderthal and humans. Well, something
even,
different.
Even before that, you know, and they said, well, was it knees? You know, because our knees are different than the ape's knees. Was it knees? Or was it, you know, something that you're close to, and that is the female sexuality? You know, yeah. I mean, because all other animals, they go into heat, but females do not. Our human female.
Yeah, and that's true. But I would argue the biggest difference between humans and every other animal is the soul. We have an ability to relate to other people, to use language, to use logic and reasoning, and to be self-aware. Not only aware of our surroundings, but we can self-reflect, and animals can do that. We can reflect on ourselves. We have self-consciousness. Something happened to consciousness, and there's definitely a jump there. But if we look back, there was something at the very beginning that had to start things. I was thinking about this today. The Big Bang started from the singularity. It either had to be one of three possibilities. It was either complete random chance, which we've talked about that, the probability of getting the Big Bang to come out of nothing and start with the perfect gravity, the perfect cosmological constant, strong and weak force, the gravity, all those things had to be just right in order to get the expansion and eventually get planets and matter and to get all that energy to become matter and eventually biomolecules and living cell and then eventually to. But anyway, that first Big Bang either had to be an accident, random chance, it had to be designed or put there, which is what we say, or it had to be of necessity. I've been hearing scientists a lot of times that are atheists say, well, it's that way because it had to be. That's not real satisfying for me, because I still say, why did it have to be that way? And where did the laws that made it the way it was, you know, they say, well, it had to develop that way.
Yeah.
If but it we didn't, don't know that.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's their logic is, if it didn't, then we wouldn't be here to discuss it.
Right. And that's the anthropic principle.
Right.
That's the only reason we're here to talk about it. But it could have been different. We could shift one value. We could change one force.
Right.
And then we wouldn't be the same. So anyway, it either had to be chance, necessity, or it was designed to be that way for a particular reason by a divine mind.
And what I'm going to say is, as a minimum, that God has stepped into the process three times.
Okay.
At the Big Bang.
To start it at the beginning. So it wasn't chance or necessity.
Okay. He stepped in and created the Big Bang. Then, 300 million years, within 300 million years of the creation of our Earth, he had to step in and create life.
Had to create life. Life couldn't have come about by chance or
by
necessity
chemicals.
No. We've talked about that.
Cannot come.
Chemical evolution. No.
Right. And then there's evolution. It goes on. Okay.
Then there's an evolutionary process. Okay.
All right. And some people would step in and say, well, he had to step in all the way through there to create this this animal or this animal or this animal.
We don't know about that.
Don't know. But I will say that according, you know, if you listen to the song from Pink Floyd, humans went along for many millions of years. Then all of a sudden, a spark, and they took off in this evolutionary jump. I mean,
a paradigm shift, explosion.
Yeah, you know, rather than going along fine for millions of years, and all of a sudden, an explosion of change
and consciousness evolution. Happened. Really, but there was a jump. There was a jump. And science doesn't jump. See, that's the problem. That's a miracle.
Right.
We call that a miracle. I don't know how you relate that to science. But anyway, Doug, that's what we're going to talk about today. Dr. Marks, who is very well qualified, you'll see he's a professor at Baylor, as you said, mathematician, engineer, written a lot of books. He's worked with William Dembski and some other big names, written books with them. And he's going to basically say, and like I say, his book's difficult, but what I got from it was he was able to do a model that's going to tell us that there had to be something more than only natural processes. There had to be something more. And you basically laid out your theory on the three points. We'll see what he says, but he's definitely at least going to give us the science, not just theory, but science that in fact there had to be a God intervene. But this is God Talk, a program where science, theology, and religion are mixed up, mingled, and dissected.
And this is God Talk, where we rightly divide the line between science and faith.
Well, sit back and relax. Get your favorite beverage. Turn down the lights. This is going to be a great show. I hope you're excited for this one. This is Dr. Robert Marks. He's going to talk to us about evolutionary informatics, his book about the process of evolution, and not only that, but I think you're going to find him to be a really fun guest. So, today on God Talk, Dr. Robert Marks. All right, so Doug, today we have Dr. Robert Marks. He's a PhD, an engineer, professor from Baylor University, and we're talking today about his book, Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics. That's the book that I've been trying to read. Now, you know I love to read books, but this has been a challenge for me.
Really?
Well, because it's got a lot of math.
Okay. Yeah, usually you can read War and Peace in one night. So.
Yeah, but when it comes to math, you know. But it's a good book. It's interesting, and we definitely need to talk about it on God Talk. We also have John Vernick with us again today. He's been on the show a few times. John, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, and he may jump in and listen and ask some questions. And we also have our special guest, Dr. Marks. So, Dr. Marks, welcome to God Talk.
Thank you. Yes, the book is challenging. I tell people there's a lot of intellectual content, and if you want to get a book without intellectual content, go buy a Don Brown novel.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. I accept the challenge. Now, you were telling us a little off air, we want to share this, you talked about this Bacon Ergo number, and we want to talk about that.
The Kevin Bacon number. I want to hear,
we want to hear
audience,
about that.
Audience, so. let them know about the Kevin Bacon number. Yes.
Okay, yeah, well, the basic idea is that there was a popular thing at one time called the 7 degrees of separation of Kevin Bacon, and it was how many movies you were separated from Kevin Bacon. So it turns out that I was in the movie Expelled with Ben Stein. Ben Stein was in the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with Kevin Bacon, which gives me a Bacon number of 2. And that's pretty exciting.
That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Now, in mathematics, there's something called an Erdos number, E-R-D-O-S. Now, Paul Erdos was an eccentric mathematician who actually kept pumped up on methamphetamines, believe it or not. And he went to people's houses and knocked at the door and said, if you let me stay with you for a month or 2 months, I'll work with you on your mathematics. As a result of that, I think he has like 600 papers, and some of his stuff is really, really good. His name is on lots of theorems and such. So, in the world of mathematics, your Erdos number is how many papers you are and co-authors removed from Paul Erdos. Now, I have a Erdos number of 3. I published with one of my students who went on to the University of Missouri, who published with somebody who published with Erdos. So your Bacon Erdos number is the sum of your Bacon number and your Erdos number. And I was telling you offline, my Bacon Erdos number is 5. By the way, it's on Wikipedia. Look it up. And, I have a better Bacon Erdos number than Stephen Hawking. Natalie Portman has a Bacon Erdos number of 6, believe it or not. She did some work at Harvard, and but I have her beat. So I have a lot of the top scientists in the world beat as far as my Bacon Erdos number. So I'm very proud of it.
Well, that's a really good way to introduce you to the audience, who you are. You were in the movie Expelled with Ben Stein, and that's one of the reasons John's here, because he's a big fan of that movie. You might just tell the audience a little bit about what that movie's about if they haven't seen it. It's been out for a while, but we talk a lot about faith and science on this show, so it's good to mention.
Well, we hear today of all of the distancing of modern college campuses against conservatism. I think a couple of days ago, Ben Shapiro was at Berkeley, and they just about shut the place down in order for him to speak. So there's lots of pushback. Well, even older than that is the pushback against anybody that would talk about the relationship between science and God, especially in the area of intelligent design. And the movie itself, Expelled, with Ben Stein, it covered the cases of a number of scientists who got dismissed or simply reprimanded for their work in intelligent design. I was one of those. It was during a time at Baylor where we had a president who actually was later fired by the Board of Regents. He was given the offer to resign, and he said, I'm not going to resign, so the Board of Regents actually fired him. So I had a website taken down that was with Bill Dembski, and it had to do with intelligent design, and they took it down, even though the material in that page has been published in a number of peer-reviewed journals since then. And it was taken down, and so I was considered enough of a victim to be to be included in the movie. Now, I should say that since then, Baylor has really turned around, except in football. We got a problem with football. I don't know if you've been watching the Baylor football.
Yeah.
But I mean, in terms of allowing that, since then, Baylor has been very open to me doing my research. My 3 children all have graduated from Baylor. So things have turned around since then. So I think that was just a temporary bump of the road for Baylor.
Well,
that's how I got in Expelled.
I'm a professor at the University of Kentucky, and we have football problems, too. I just wanted to tell you, I empathize with you on that, Doug.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to go a little bit into your background. I know that you studied mathematics and also information technology, but it says on your report here that you're a professor of engineering. So mathematics and information technology is science. So do you consider yourself a scientist or an engineer, or what's the connection there?
Well, actually, I proudly consider myself an engineer, and I tell you why. There's a distinct difference between scientists and engineers. Scientists come up with theories that they vet them, and they put them up on a throne like a queen, and they worship the queen and often defend this. We actually see this in Darwinian evolution, for example. You know, the queen is up there, and we must protect her at all costs. Engineers, on the other hand, have typically as much knowledge as the scientists and the mathematicians, and we make the queen come down from the throne, scrub the floor, and if she doesn't work, we fire her. So that is the big difference between the scientist and the engineer. So I am an engineer. I know as much as a lot of scientists in terms of the mathematics and the background, but I'm also interested in reducing things to practice. And when you talk about intelligent design and such things, engineers design things. I mean, we're the ones with the expertise in that area, so it's sure. very natural that an engineer would become involved in that.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about when you became a Christian and how that your Christian walk has impacted your scientific and engineering work.
Oh, my gosh. I came to Christ when I was a junior in college, and before that, I had some problems. I actually decided on a career in electrical engineering, and I took my first two courses, and I failed them in electrical engineering. But I heard the gospel of Christ. It was compelling. There was a number of people that had an input into that. My father, I had an uncle that was a POW in World War II, and he had come to Christ as a result of some of the, you know, stress that ex-POWs had, and we had long conversations. So in my bedroom alone, I bowed my head, and I asked Christ into my life. And it became a big deal with me. Everything made sense as soon as I came to Christ. Before that, nothing made sense. You have to ask, why are you here? I knew that why I was here. And all of a sudden, my studies took on a new excitement. I did very well, went on and got my PhD, and God has been with me since then. As far as the impact, I went to academia, and there is pressure in academia. I was 26 years at the University of Washington, and there's pressure in academia to not talk about, you know, Christianity or anything. So mm-hmm. I was what they called a closet Christian there for many years, kind of afraid to stick out mm-hmm. my toe into the water or reach out my arm, thinking I might get back a bloody stump. Mm-hmm. But I was approached by one of the staff members of there, Brian Rickey, who continues to be a very close friend. And we talked for a while, and he asked me to be the faculty advisor for Campus Crusade for Christ, which is now, of course, CRU. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And I says, well, I don't know about this stuff, like an intelligent designing, you know, about Genesis and stuff. And I get, you know, somebody comes up and asks me, and I don't know what to say. And his response was, well, you're going to have to find out. So he started me out in looking at some of these things, and I'm always indebted to him for doing that. So, and now here at Baylor, we run an apologetics group. It turns out that, up to 80% of students who come to universities, this is an astonishing figure, but 80% of students who come to college who have been going to church all their lives stop going to church. And it's jaw-dropping, and it's sad. Now Baylor celebrates the Lordship of Christ, and I don't know what the figure is here, but one of the challenges with it is some of these students have not been offered the answers to some of the questions which are proposed to them by professors at the university. Sure. And they go, oh my gosh, maybe what I have believed isn't true. And so one of the things that apologetics does, which I think right now is a very important ministry for universities, is to go back and show the rationality of being a Christian, that indeed science doesn't disprove God. Science actually celebrates God, and sure. and how that happens. So there's an apologetics group here. and the students run it. I'm just the one of the advisors, and the other one is an organization called the American Scientific Affiliation, which is a group of scientists that are Christian that do the same thing. So those are currently my ministries here.
Excellent ministry, and you're a perfect guest to be on God Talk. I mean, you really are. I can't believe we haven't had you before. That's really kind of how this started. I lost any faith that I had, which was childlike faith, when I went to medical school because of what you just talked about, and then later became a believer when I was in my late 30s, and ultimately went to seminary, and now I'm a pastor. But long story short, I lost the faith that I had because I couldn't explain what I believed and why, and there wasn't an apologetic minister. I'd never even heard of apologetics back then. So it's very dear to my heart, and that's partly why we started God Talk, to promote the conversation between faith and science. So, wow, you're a perfect guest.
Well, thank you. You're familiar with Stephen Hawking, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
He said, who was not a Christian, but he said, in terms of physics, this was a remarkable statement by him, and it just hit me as being very important. He said, in physics, you never prove anything. You just accumulate evidence. And I think that is somewhat true of the Christian faith. I had so many questions when I came to Christ. But as time has gone on through apologetics, those questions have been answered. So in essence, I knew of the salvation story. I knew about the Holy Spirit in me. But I have accumulated evidence about the Christian faith and how it makes sense in the world we live in terms of science and society and all sorts of things. So that's what apologetics does, I think, at least one of the dimensions of what it does, is let people accumulate evidence as their faith. So when these students come to the university, I think that the churches need to give them a little bit more apologetics so that they can defend their faith a little bit better and have answers to these difficult questions they're being asked.
Couldn't agree more. Dr. Marks, if you could sort of contrast the theories of origins of how human beings came to be on this earth, and for the audience, explain the difference between the Darwinian paradigm, intelligent design, and creationism. Those terms get tossed around a lot. I'd like to what do you mean by those terms, and where do you fall?
Well, let's first of all differentiate between the origin of life and the evolution of life.
Good, yeah.
I don't think there's any debate about the origin of life. There's no debate, because even in itself, Stephen Hawking says, not Stephen Hawking, but Dawkins.
Dawkins, yeah.
Says nobody knows where life originated from, and
sure,
we still don't know. I have a good friend here at Baylor, Keith Schubert, who's going over to Japan to give a talk. He's a good Christian. He's actually he's a professor and he's a Baptist pastor. But he's going over to Japan to give a plenary talk for an Origin of Life conference. They're still investigating it. They still don't know where life came from. And so this remains a mystery, I think, across the board. Mm. And I don't think that we're making any inroads to it. The original existence of life is so complex. Where did it come from? And Darwin's book was entitled Origin of the Species, not Origins of the Species. Hmm. He believes that there was a single cell which popped up from the primordial ooze that started evolving, if you will. So there is that problem from the scientific community. And I think from very serious scientists, and it's been there for quite some time, and it's going to remain there, I believe, for a long, long time, because the creation of life is just no simple task. The information content in life, even at the simplest form, is just jaw-dropping. It's like the information required to put together a 747 jet. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
So that with that, there is this. Now, with that's the origin of life. Now, there's the evolution question. And in Christianity, there's three different theories about the origin of life. The first one would be the literal interpretation of Genesis, the sort of theory which is advanced by Ken Ham and his Great Ark. I've never been there. Any of you guys gone to that?
I have been there. I took my kids.
Is it really awesome as they say it is?
Well, the Ark really is neat. We went through it and let the kids see it, and we actually went with John.
It's a little expensive, I've heard. I've never been.
Yeah, but it's quite worth, if you're in the area, it's worth seeing, I thought it was really neat.
I really would like to see that. Oh, anyway, that's the first, the literal, the sometimes it's called the young earth, origins sort of paradigm. Then there is the intelligent design program. Intelligent design believes that in the old universe, that the universe is, what, 3 billion years old or something like that, and that indeed something did happen. But in order for that to happen, there had to be the intervention of God along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be the intelligent design sort of approach. Then there are the theistic evolutionists, which I don't understand, because I get with theistic evolution, and they actually believe in Darwinian evolution, and they say that they can be Christians too. Right. And I talk to them, and I say, where's the theism in theistic evolution? Well, they all say it started kind of at the creation of the universe, and all the information was there, and it's just unraveling as time goes on. So these are the three different theories.
But intelligent design, as I understand it, also tries to take what we might call an inductive approach, though. As opposed to saying, you know, it must be this way. They'll say, well, we're looking at the data and then trying to come up with theories as to how this might happen. The reason I bring up that distinction is the difference between creationism and intelligent design is intelligent design is at least purported or reported as a scientific approach at analyzing the data of what's there, an inductive approach as opposed to a deductive approach. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that that's a fair assessment, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, how did you come to write this book and get motivated to write a book about Darwinian evolution?
Well, my background is computational intelligence. That would include machine intelligence, artificial intelligence, neural networks. I was the editor-in-chief of the IEEE Transactions on Neural Networks. I think probably Doug has heard of IEEE.
Absolutely.
It's the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. It's the biggest organization, professional organization in the world. It has over 400,000 members, so that's a lot.
I was a member.
So I was... Oh, were you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I still am. And I became the president of the IEEE Neural Networks Council, and later on it became the IEEE Computational Intelligence Society. We coined the term computational intelligence. I co-edited a book, the first book that had the term computational intelligence in it. So I had this background. Now, part of computational intelligence is evolutionary computing. Now, one might think on first flush that, oh my gosh, evolutionary computing is an acceptance of Darwinian evolution. It isn't. It isn't. Rather, evolutionary computing is looking at a large number of solutions and attempting from those large number of solutions to choose one that meets some sort of engineering design. So it does have a goal in mind. I think the Darwinists would say that evolution has no goal in mind. It's something like a blind, greedy process. Mm-hmm. And I actually published my first paper on evolutionary computing from an engineering perspective last century. Since then, I was actually contracted by the Navy to do evolution of swarms on the computer.
Wow.
And we did it, and we got some just fascinating results from it. So I was exposed primarily to evolution through the through the engineering perspective. Then I had a chance meeting in 2003 or 2004 with William Dembski. Are you familiar with William Dembski?
Oh, yes, yeah. He's done
he's done great work. And we were in a faculty apologetics group led by Walter Bradley. Now, Walter Bradley is one of the pioneers in pioneers in intelligent design. He co-wrote a book in, I think it was 1988, that actually was the first to actually challenge the complexity of the design of life. It was called The Mystery of Life's Origins. So Walter is one of my heroes. He was, I'm a Baylor because of Walter, but anyway, he put together this apologetics group. I met Bill Dembski, and I had read some of his stuff, and I said, Dr. Dembski, this is really good stuff. And he grabbed me after the group and says, so you're really into this evolutionary computing? I said, yeah. He said, I want to talk to you. So he talked to me about a new book he just released called No Free Lunch. And in the No Free Lunch, it basically said that without guidance, evolution could never happen. And this is a Darwinian posturing. They believe that evolution happens without any purpose, without any design. Now, in engineering, you always have to have a design. You always have to have a goal.
Right.
And I started looking at it, and Bill said, you know what they're doing? They're sneaking information in here to make it work. Mm-hmm. He said, it's random, but it's just like a steel ball in a pinball machine. It bounces around differently all the time, but it always ends up in the little hole behind the flippers. it's different, but it's... And so we started to look at it. And I looked at it, came up with actually a measure, how you could measure in bits the amount of information which was snuck into into evolutionary computing. Now, the importance of this was that at the time there were things going on with a lot of people from the biological side proposing their own models of evolution. Mm-hmm. And one of the most famous was the Evita model. Now, you might not have heard of Evita, but have you heard of Kitzinger versus Dover? The Kitzinger versus Dover trial, I think it's about 10 years old, was a kind of a modern Scopes monkey trial.
Okay.
This school district wanted to put this little sticker on their biology book saying that the stuff that was taught in the biology book wasn't the only way, that indeed there was this other thing called intelligent design. Mm-hmm. So in comes the ACLU, and there's this big trial called Kitzinger versus Dover. And one of the authors of this Evita program came in and said, wow, you know, no, we've shown evolution because it's right here in this computer model. And that was one of the reasons that intelligent design lost in that trial, was that sort of thing. So we sat down with... We sat down with one of my students at the time, brilliant young man called Winston Ewart, and we actually analyzed the Evita program and showed, measured in bits, how much information they had snuck in to make their computer program work. Now, I don't think it was intentional. I think they're kind of numbed by familiarity and, gosh, yeah, how's it going to work if we don't guide it? But we actually showed that. We published an IEEE paper on it, and we showed that all of these claims about evolution was just garbage with Evita. And then we've looked at other evolutionary programs offered by the biology community and shown the same thing. In fact, we kind of got tired of it because all of them have this information infused to make them work. So the bottom line, and one of the conclusions of the book, is that undirected Darwinian evolution has no model. There's no model for undirected Darwinian evolution. As such, since there's no mathematics behind it, it is not a hard science.
Right.
It's still a soft science.
And that's where I want to kind of start with, broadly speaking, because on God Talk, we try to just seek truth. We're a Christian show, and we believe in God and in Jesus Christ, but we always look for truth and where it leads. And I think we need to start with the broad question of, you know, that a lot of people just assume evolution is true because it's in biology books. But your contention would be, Of course, I question it, not from theological ground. I question it scientifically. But your contention would be that evolution is, in fact, not true or not provable and is a theory, but doesn't have any mathematical proof behind it. That would be your contention, right? We want to be clear on this.
You're talking about evolution, not the creation of life, but just evolution.
Just the evolution. Well, that's a good point. We're talking about origin of life, and then the second question of just once we start with a cell, can we go from that information to human beings? That's what we're talking about.
Well, could it be, just let me step in here real quick, could it be that God has stepped in several times, as a minimum, has stepped in several times over the eons? He stepped in, he created the Big Bang. Later on, he steps in and he creates the origin of life. Then he steps in later on and says, here's a human, because humanoid went along perfect for millions of years, and then all of a sudden it took off. Well, why did it take off?
Well, again, that's putting information in.
Then right. He stepped in 2,000 years ago and gave us Christ.
Let's talk about the difference between sneaking information and an unguided process. Let's start there.
Okay.
What do you say to that?
Okay. There was a great paper. Now, everything I'm talking to you about is science. These are in peer-reviewed archival journals. There was a paper by Wolpert and McCready, and they popularized an idea called the no-free lunch, which was as follows. If you're trying to get some sort of outcome, if you're trying to search for a good result out of a large number of possibilities, that one procedure was about as good as another procedure. In fact, that was their conclusion. And it really put back the people in computational intelligence and machine intelligence, because before then, everybody says, well, my algorithm is better than your algorithm in determining output. But what Wolpert McCready said was that in order to get anything of meaning out, that you had to bias your computer program in order to get something out meaningful. So this means that if, I talked about evolutionary computing and engineering, this means that in general, if you know nothing about the problem you're trying to solve, evolutionary computing is as good as just random sampling. And if you just do random sampling, you say, okay, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try this, it's as good. And that was actually astonishing. Let me give you an example, if I could, really quick.
Yeah, sure.
You're making a pancake. You're trying to design a pancake, and your design parameters are how much you cook it on side one and how much you cook it on side two. So we're going to divide up side one into intervals of 15 seconds. So you can cook it for 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 45 seconds, et cetera, up to 10 different possibilities. Same thing on side number two. Now, what you have to do is you have to look through those recipes and find a good one. Now, we're going to assume there's a guy there, a professional taster. We're going to call him Bob the Taster. Okay. And he tastes your pancake, and he smacks his lips and says, this is a three. Nah, that's no good. So we keep on. Now, how many different recipes, if you have no knowledge of what you're doing, how many recipes are there? There's 100.
Okay.
There's 10 times 10.
Okay.
Now, if you add another ingredient, say the stove setting, and suppose the stove setting goes from 1 to 10. So now you have both cooking on side one, cooking on side two, and then the actual stove setting and 10 different things. All of a sudden, you have 10 times 10 times 10, or 1,000 different recipes that you have to go through. Now, go to the other case where you're actually mixing up the batter. You put in 1 egg to 10 eggs, you put in 1 cup of pancake mix to 10, 1 cup of milk to 10 cups, same thing with water. And if you have 9 of those different elements, all of a sudden you have 1 billion different possibilities.
Wow.
1 billion. So that's something called the curse of dimensionality. And in the problems that computers are trying to solve, that's very small in terms of the possible number of solutions that you have to solve. Now, what can you do? If you have no expertise, you have to go in and you say, well, I'm going to try this recipe. Bob says, that's a 4. Oh, gosh, I got to go back and do another one. Okay, that one's a 3. Now, the thing is if you have domain expertise, And you go in and you say, you know what? If I use 10 cups of, or 5 cups of milk and it's too watery, I don't want to use 6 cups of milk. So all of a sudden you apply some expertise to guide your search. Okay. So you begin to cut out things. You've heard of, Tesla and Edison. You've heard of Edison's designing of a light bulb?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
He tried thousands of different things for the filaments, and he celebrated for doing that. Nikola Tesla, who's one of the fathers of electrical engineering, came up and said, Edison's stupid. He said, Edison doesn't take the time for any book learning. If he just sat down and read a book about physical properties or something, he could have reduced the number of elements that he tried down to a tenth of what he did. So Edison didn't bring in domain expertise.
I see.
And, here's another example. WD-40. Do you know why they call it WD-40?
Water displacement number 44.
WD-40 took 40 trials before it was perfected.
Number 40.
Yeah, 40 times. Okay.
Water displacement.
It was invented by an industrial chemist. Now, suppose a high school student had gone in with little domain expertise. We might be using WD-5 million or something, right?
Man, that's a good way to describe it. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we're talking about a design of something even as simple as the first cell, it's these complexities that we're dealing with. So we have billions and trillions of possible solutions, and we need domain expertise. We need that information snuck into the way that we extract the information.
So this is what you talk about in the book about a blind search then, and a search algorithm, right?
Yes. Yes.
Can you describe what you mean in terms of the computer, a blind search versus a domain expertise?
Okay.
I mean, in ways we could understand, yeah.
I have a great example. There's, do you guys know Weird Al Yankovic?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a movie called UHF, and there was this one scene in there where there were two guys sitting on a park bench, and one of them had a Rubik's Cube, and he was blind. It was very clear. He had on the glasses. He had the cane. And sitting next to him was a guy with that obviously could see. And the blind guy gave the Rubik's Cube a twist and said, "Is this it?" And the guy that looked at it said, "Nope, that isn't it." And then he gave it another twist. He says, "Is this it?" And the guy went, "No." That is literally, and also in terms of the story, a blind search. You have no idea. You're not using any domain expertise or anything else in order to solve that Rubik's Cube. And that's what's done in computers also.
Okay.
The same sort of thing. You have to bring in this bias, this domain expertise. Otherwise, you use a blind search, and it's going to take you forever to find out what the result is. And according to the No Free Lunch Theorem, that was the title of Bill Dembski's book, according to the No Free Lunch Theorem, if you know nothing about the problem you're about to solve, one search is going to be as good as any other search.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
That's pretty incredible.
So that's where we want to be clear about definitions. When we talk about the neo-Darwinian evolutionary process, or what we classically call Darwinism, It would include a blind, undirected process without information.
Because
you were talking about information input from an intelligence.
Right.
But that's not really what people mean when they say neo-Darwinian evolution. They're talking about a blind, undirected process, right?
Yes, that's true. Yes, exactly.
Okay. And so that's what it is that you're challenging. And as you began to develop a model, tell us a little bit about how you did that and what, you know, the engineering and the math behind that, trying to get at an endpoint, I assume. You're designing the endpoint you want, and you're trying to see if the computer can generate a pathway to that. Would that be right? I mean, in broad strokes?
Yes, that would be it. And fundamentally, again, we were able to look at a computer algorithm that had a specific goal in mind, and we were able to measure how much information was being imported into that computer program, and we can measure it in bits. So that's kind of cool. It's something we call active information, and that was the subject of one of our first IEEE papers. It was a journal paper that Bill and I wrote. And it was celebrated because ID was criticized by not having very many archival journal papers from the general technical community being published, and we published a whole bunch of them. That's the fundamental. We also answered some other questions. We would say maybe we were just lucky, and evolution fits the environment that we're in. So we're just lucky. We also wrote a paper called this is a little mind bending here. It's the search for the search. If you're how do you search for a good search? Because the physicists appeal to the anthropic principle.
Sure.
The anthropic principle being, well, you know, if it didn't happen this way, then we wouldn't be here to question it.
Right.
That's basically.
So we're basically lucky because it just happened to hit the jackpot.
Yes, exactly. So we did another paper, which originally was Bill's idea, and then I came up with an independent derivation. We looked at it, and we go, wow, we did the same thing, but differently. And so we published both of those derivations in a paper called The Search for the Search. And what happens is you can't kick the can down the road because it becomes more and more difficult. In fact, it becomes exponentially more difficult to search for a search. So you can't kick the can down the road and say, well, we're just lucky that we're here.
Now, is your modeling attempting to develop a model for coming up with one functional cell, or the process of coming up with just random molecules all the way to consciousness and self-awareness and a complex human being? I mean, how did you go about modeling that?
Well, here's something. I'm going to answer that kind of indirectly. One of the problems with computers is that they cannot create information. If you have a blind evolutionary search, it is not going to be able to create information.
Okay.
Now, this actually bleeds over into the current debate we have about artificial intelligence. There is a big debate about artificial intelligence and the danger of artificial intelligence or machine intelligence of the future. Are computers going to be able to gain consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
And are they going to take over like in the Terminator, like Skynet and zap us all? And the answer to that, leading from the evolutionary work, it's the same conclusion. No, computers can only do what they're told. They cannot create information. And therefore, any of these ideas about sentience or consciousness or understanding or especially creativity are not going to be happening with the computer. So evolution is, you can't get there. It's just like evolution. Evolution purports to be a process, an algorithm, if you will, that actually generates all of this exciting information that gets more and more significant. That's the same way that current machine intelligence is purporting to do. And it isn't going to do it. Computers are unable to do that. That's what we discovered in the evolution work, but it's also applicable to machine intelligence today.
I think you're going to disappoint a lot of Star Trek fans because they had Commander Data, who was a walking android who can do all this creativity, and they actually had other animated objects that were actually became sentient. So you're saying none of that can happen ever?
Nope, none of that's going to happen. There's a great philosopher named John Searle who came up with an example called Searle's Chinese Room, and he paints a picture of this guy that sits in a little room, and the guy is fed little I forget which way the translation goes, but let's say little things in Chinese, statements in Chinese. And he goes to this big bank of file cabinets. I still think people know what file cabinets are, but I'm not sure. And he goes to this big bank of file cabinets, and he looks in until he finds a match. And his job is to, I'm changing a little bit, but his job is to translate Chinese into Portuguese. And so he looks there, and every card has the Chinese phrase and the Portuguese phrase. So he looks until he finds a match, and then he comes back and he copies down the match and he slips it out the door. this is what computers do. Now, does that little guy, does he understand Portuguese? No. Does he understand Chinese? No. It sure looks like from the outside that he does, but no. So therefore, computers will never have understanding of what they're going to do. I just read a little article about when Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue, and a guy was questioning the humanity of Deep Blue, and he said, "Look, it's not a human being. It's just a complicated computer program. Does Deep Blue care whether it wins or loses?" No. Garry Kasparov did. Is Deep Blue thinking about going out with Deep Pink for a date tonight? There is nothing there. Computers can only do what they're told to do, and this, by the way, there's firm math behind this that's taught to every computer science. Computers can only do so-called algorithms. They can only take recipes and execute those recipes, step-by-step procedures to do something. Now, the question is, are there things which are non-algorithmic that can't be done by step-by-step procedures? Now, Alan Turing, who is the guy that started, he's kind of the father of computer science in the 30s. They made a movie about him called The Imitation Game, where he cracked the Enigma code for the Nazis. But he also, the guy was really smart. And Turing actually showed very simply there were things computers could never do. You could never write a computer program to analyze basically what another computer program was going to do. Hmm. One of them, is that computer program going to stop or is it going to run forever? You can't write a computer program to actually make that assertion. So, therefore, he actually proved that there were things which were non-algorithmic. Yes. And I think that there's lots of movement now towards saying that the things that we are experiencing, such as consciousness, understanding, sentience, creativity, are themselves non-algorithmic. You cannot write a computer program to do them.
We have several things we have to hit on here, but one is just information in biological systems. Can you kind of explain that information is not only complex, but it's specified complexity? And I've heard you use the example before about a snowflake is complex, but it's not specific. It could be different. So that's an important part of it, isn't it? The information in cells is not only complicated, but it's specific, specified.
Yes. In fact, we talk about this in the book, and Winston Ewart, who's one of the co-authors, came up with what I think is just a brilliant measure of how you measure the algorithmic specified complexity of stuff. It turns out complex stuff happens all the time. But the question is whether it's specified or not. And I'll give you an example. This is from something called Kolmogorov information theory. You're familiar with 3D printers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Suppose you had a 3D printer that printed out a bust of Lincoln, mm-hmm. really detailed, including the mole on his cheek and things like that. And then you had another computer program that printed out a bowling ball. Now, which computer program do you think would be the shortest? It would be for the bowling ball.
Yeah,
because a bowling ball is really simple. So therefore, the bust of Lincoln is more complex than the bowling ball. Yet, on the other hand, I could probably go out in the yard and get myself a rock, maybe a moon rock or something, which had a bunch of indentations and which had the same sort of complexity as Lincoln's bust. And I could write a program for that and assume it was about as long as for Lincoln's bust. That would be something which didn't have specificity. See, Lincoln has specificity, so it's complex, number one, and number two, it's something we can relate to. It is something which has been specified.
Has meaning, rock, right?
Yeah, it has meaning, exactly. So that's the idea of specified complexity. Now, we don't get into the biology in there. I'm not a biologist.
Mm-hmm.
But we do get to the idea of measuring specified complexity and how that in itself can be measured in bits. And Winston's work was the first time that this was able to be done and actually measured in bits. And that was pretty cool. I was really excited when he came up with the idea.
It really is. Is it reasonable that we could pretty well map or write a mathematical program that would model any kind of process? I mean, that might be a question someone would ask. I mean, should we be able to model? I mean, you said there are some things maybe that can't be modeled, like consciousness, or you can't write an algorithm for it. But what about just the process of modeling something like evolution? Could somebody just come back and say, well, it's just not possible to be modeled? Doesn't mean it didn't happen in a biological system.
Well, I think that the results of the book actually show that no, that is simply not possible. And that something is happening that doesn't allow the typical Darwinian evolution to occur. It cannot be something which is happening randomly. Right. It just can't happen. Now, there's other sort of models that the first one was a computer program called Tierra. Now, their idea was to go in the computer and generate this information-rich environment. And that's what the Darwinists would say, is that we're in this information-rich environment, and we adapt to this environment, and that's the reason that amoebas become guppies, and guppies become squids, etc. This is something which is called open-ended evolution. And it is currently a hot topic among the biologists and among the people that are attempting to create evolution. But I would go back to the search for the search. And I also have a PhD student now, Eric Holloway, who is looking into algorithmic information theory, which shows that open-ended evolution in itself must be bounded. There's a certain place that you can't get more complex. It has a ceiling of how far it can operate.
Sure. Just to play devil's advocate, Dawkins said in his book Blind Watchmaker, and I don't have the exact quote, but he described some kind of computer simulation that he did that took into account mutation and so forth and developed a creature. So I'm just wondering how he would respond, or how has he responded to your work, you know?
Well, this is Dawkins' famous computer program where he tried to evolve the phrase "methinks it is like a weasel."
Yes,
and that's a saying from Hamlet, I believe. Well, if he just did this, but from choosing letters and saying, "Okay, I'm going to choose these," I don't know how many letters it is, 27, I believe. He chooses 27 letters, and like the guy sitting on the park bench, he says, "Is this it?" "No." So he picks another 27 layers or 27 letters, and he said, "Is this it?" "No." And he keeps on doing that. That would take him forever to do trillions of years in order to find the proper thing. So therefore, he needs to guide it somewhere. And you know what he does? He actually has a little thing in there called an oracle, and you're given a result, and it says seven of these letters are right and the rest of them are wrong.
Oh, okay.
So just that knowledge is enough to guide him to a success. That's knowledge. That's domain expertise, which he is sneaking into the algorithm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the bottom line here is that evolution, you're saying, from your modeling, couldn't happen unless there's information put into it, unless there's domain expertise. It couldn't happen as a blind. Would that be the thesis, basically?
Yes. So-called unguided Darwinian evolution doesn't exist. It is not a hard science. I think we've pretty well definitively shown that it will never be a hard science, although I think in science you never say never, and maybe there's something I'm overlooking. I don't think we are. But one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century, Gregory Chaitin, put out a challenge. He said, "The honor of mathematics requires us to come up with a mathematical theory of evolution and either prove that Darwin was wrong or right." And I think that we have met that challenge and shown that no, it's wrong.
Wow. I mean, that's a strong claim. Mutations, I've always been, one of the things always bother me about evolutionary theory is that mutations in medicine, at least from the way I see it, are usually damaging.
Yes.
Isn't that correct? I mean, is that your understanding?
But,
But wait a minute, we have dogs. Differences between one species of dog and another dog, and it all came from wolves. So
that would also be microevolution or adaptation, though. Bacteria, you know, can develop resistance to an antibiotic, and it changes. And in the same way, you can get a variation within a kind. And I think that's different, though, than the overall process of the unguided Darwinian evolution.
But we didn't
right?
make a fish from a wolf.
Right. How do you respond to that?
I would say that the things you're describing as microevolution, I like to use the word adaptation. I heard of the Darwin's Galapagos finches and how their beaks changed. And they thought it would take millions of years, and then they moved it to an isolated island to do some tests, and they found it happened in 17 years or something. So the information was already in the organism.
Right.
And things were just adapting. And I would say, as an engineer, that is really intelligent design. When I design things that are adaptive to the environment, I have a good design. And that is very different than the macroevolution, where, as you said, there is one kind going to another.
Yeah. So basically, the information is there, and God has designed this system to certainly adapt and change and develop those speciation, but, you know, difference within species. But and then that's where we get confused, though. I think we get confused trying to look at micro changes or adaptive changes, and then trying to extrapolate that to saying, okay, now we've just got a bunch of molecules, and it's going to eventually become a human being. Those are the jumps.
I'm thinking of it like this: you've got a bunch of birds that flew to an island. They're separated. They're isolated. Only those that could actually get to the fruit or to the flower and eat, they lived. All the other ones, they died out, and so
natural selection.
And their offspring had that same trait.
That's true.
But now, if you was to take 10,000 wolves and you put them out in the middle of the ocean, I guarantee you, every single one of them are going to die. They don't adapt that quickly. They're not going to evolve quick enough that they're not going to die, right?
Yeah, and so natural selection is sort of the process of selecting out an undirected process, unguided, just because certain animals are able to adapt better and pass on their genes.
But they had those genes already.
But they had them already, right.
That's right.
That's the big difference. And I think that where I find when I talk to people about this, the confusion comes in that and then just extrapolating it to this big process that really isn't provable. And that's really the great argument of this book that I think is really strong.
One of the things about extrapolation, I did a lot of work in extrapolation when I was a younger guy, but extrapolation is something which is referred to as ill-posed. Mm. Ill-posed is a problem where you're trying to extrapolate or forecast the future. And if you had sprinkled just a little bit of uncertainty on your data, your forecast will be totally different. I think Niels Bohr, he was a pioneer in quantum mechanics, he says, forecasting is very dangerous, especially if it's about the future. So he recognized the difficulty of extrapolation. You put a little bit of uncertainty in there, and it totally screws up your forecast. And I think if you look back through all of the scientists that have actually done forecasting, there's been a few which have been right on. But there's lots of them that were just terrible. I think Lord Kelvin said, we'll never have heavier-than-air flight. He said, we'll never be able to tap the power of the atom. He also said that, I think in the year 2020, that all the oxygen of the world would be used up, so we're going to suffocate, which is not good news. But here was a guy who was renowned. He was renowned for his scientific accomplishments. But when he became a forecaster, he was terrible.
Well, I think, I agree, and that's a really helpful commentary on extrapolation. People will simply push back that are evolutionists and say, given enough time, you know, if we just give it enough years, millions, millions and millions of years, it will eventually happen. And that's what you would push back against, correct? That time isn't enough to get information.
there's something called the Planck unit. It's the smallest unit which people measure. It's, if you're familiar with strength, a Planck unit is so small that if you scaled a Planck unit up to an inch, the diameter of a proton would be several light years.
Okay.
That's really small, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So,
right.
So, and then there's the Planck time, and that's the time it takes light to go across the Planck distance.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, so that's really small too, right? So, so suppose you made little Planck cubes, little cubes that are one Planck length on the side. And we were to ask how many of those filled our known universe.
Hmm.
Then we were to ask if we went to the, if we assumed the Big Bang sort of theory, if since then we divided up time into Planck time, and we multiplied those two together.
Hmm.
That would be a pretty big number.
That would be a very, very big number, yeah.
Okay, now imagine me going out and choosing a Planck cube somewhere in time, and you going out and choosing a Planck cube in time. The probability those two would be the same would be zero. In fact, there's something called Borel's Law, which Borel says when probabilities get so small, it becomes impossible.
There you go.
Yeah, if you're familiar with quantum mechanics, there's probably there's a finite probability if you're sitting in a chair that you will tunnel through the chair. Through the chair. It's just never going to happen. Well, the question is, if you had a target phrase and you were to take that phrase and you were to just choose random letters to get the phrase, how long do you think that... Well, let me just tell you, if you have that probabilistic resource, is one chance out of that humongous number, you would have the probability to choose a phrase, and this is going to sound mind-blowing, but it's in the book, so you have to look at it, of only 79 letters. So, and that's with blood, that's with no domain expertise, that's with no guidance. So, therefore, no, that isn't going to happen. I'm sorry. The universe, even by the intelligent design or theistic evolution account, the universe is not old enough and it's not large enough to allow that to happen. Bill Bemsky calls it the probabilistic resource of the universe. And we've really taken and extended it, I think, to the exact limit to which it could be done. And the argument that, hey, there's probably going to be something in there. You know, there's a chance. It reminds me of Dumb and Dumber. Have you seen Dumb and Dumber?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You
admit to it, huh? Okay. You remember Jim Carrey talking to Mary and saying, what's my chance? Is it 1 in 100? And she says, no, it's 1 in about, I would say more like 1 in 1,000,000. And then he lights up and he's saying, so you're telling me there's a chance?
Great line, yeah.
And the reason that's funny is because people know it's so stupid that 1 in 1,000,000 is just stupid. And that's why it's funny. And that is exactly what the Darwinists are doing by saying that, there's a probability going to happen. Bill calls that the probability of the gaps.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the fact that something is going to happen, well, let's throw up our hands and say, you know, it could happen. There is this probability.
Instead of turn to a divine, you know, it's just an overwhelming, and even I liked what he used. I'd never heard that before, Borel's Law or whatever, that it when probabilities get so low, it becomes impossible. And I like that we can actually say that. Because that's the way it feels, and it's nice to actually have that. Well, we're about out of time. We've taken up your hour. Do you have any other questions, or is there anything, Dr. Marks, that we didn't hit on about your book? I want to promote your book and give you a chance to do that. But
okay, thank you. The book is Evolutionary Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics. Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics. I heard I'm supposed to say it three times. Evolutionary Informatics. It is available on Amazon.com. Now, one of the things that we did with the book is we took all of these papers that only a nerd could appreciate and tried to make it more accessible. But if you want the original papers, if you are a nerd and you want to dig down deep, go to the site evoinfo.com. By the way, it's EVOINFO. My wife says it sounds like evil info, but no, it's Evo Info. EvoInfo.org. 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 And there are links to all of the papers there, which have the nitty-gritty details if you're interested in the details.
Absolutely. This has been really good.
Yeah. I got one real quick question. Are we going to see Baylor in the Final Four this year in March?
Well, who beat who?
Unlikely that we'll see Baylor in any final, anything, I think.
Well, they've been.
It's possible. And it's one in a million. There's a chance.
Okay, yeah, we'll see.
All right. Thank you so much for being on God Talk, and we'll continue to promote your work. And hope we have you back again sometime. This was really good. Enjoyed it.
Okay. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
God bless.
Blessings. Bye-bye. Uh-huh.
So, Doug, that was Dr. Robert Marks. He's really fun to interview. I enjoyed him. And John, you know, we have John here with us today. I really liked how he started out talking about his Bacon Eros number.
His Bacon Eros number. All right,
you know anything about that? Yeah.
Well, he said that he was in, he was with Ben Stein.
And Expelled.
In Expelled. And Ben Stein was in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And
with Kevin Bacon.
All right. So I was like, I know that movie very well. And I was like, where in the world was Kevin Bacon in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
He's been in everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where was Kevin Bacon in that movie? I don't know.
I don't know. I just looked it up while we're on the air here.
You know,
he might
have been.
It's a bit part, but he's still in there. And so
that gave him a Bacon of two.
Right.
And he has an Eros of three, I believe, which means he wrote a paper with somebody three times removed from Eros, the scientist. So he has a total Bacon Eros number of five, which I feel privileged. Maybe we could just interview Kevin Bacon.
There you go.
And have a one, right? Well, okay. He started out talking about Ben Stein, the movie Expelled. And there I want to mention the issue of separation of God from the college campus. And he was in that movie because of his own experience where you can't talk about God, you can't talk about your faith on the college campus. You can't mingle those two because of, I guess, separation of religion and academics, or God and academics, or separation of church and state. What do you think about that?
All right. We've been over this several times. So we actually had one of our best interviews was with a fellow who talked about what exactly was the separation of church and state.
Right.
And what was the founding fathers thinking about. And
that was an early interview.
Early interview.
A long time ago. It was one of our first ones.
Yeah. The religion of our founding fathers, that everybody knew what the founding fathers were thinking for 150 years until FDR appointed Hugo Black. And Hugo Black, all of a sudden, he went from establishment of a church to this separation of church and state.
That's where it really started, this
right.
idea.
Before that, it was establishment of a church. And everybody knows what that means.
Right.
That means
you can't establish a religion.
And we talked about Martin Luther.
Yeah.
Right? The Lutheran church was an established religion in Sweden.
Right.
So that is an established church. That is where the church and the government are basically one and the same. We don't have that here
in
America.
We can't do that. No.
Right. And our founding father says we don't want to do that. So they put in the Constitution that says.
And wait a minute. Why did they not want to do that? Because they didn't want the government to establish a church and try to control religion.
Right.
I mean, they also didn't want religion to get into the government. But really, I think that wasn't their primary thing. They were more concerned about the government forming a church and making you, because they didn't want to go back to what England had,
and all of Europe. Yeah, they knew exactly what an established church is, right? A state-run religion. They didn't want a state-run religion. And so they said that the federal government will not create any laws. That's what the Constitution says. It says the federal government will not create any laws that establishes
Federal religion, right?
It will not create any laws that establishes a federal religion or restricts thereof, the practice thereof, right? So that doesn't say a separation of church and state by any means. It says they won't create any laws. I mean, how do you go from the federal government will not create any laws to now we can't have a coach, a football coach, after a game, can't go out onto the field and pray at the 50-yard line in the center of the field because somebody, some kid or some parent may look at him out there praying on his knees in the field and say, hey, you're establishing a religion or your separation of church and state. How does that fit?
It's gone so far that now the college campus cannot even speak of God. And that was not the intent of the founding fathers. In fact, think of it. Harvard was founded as a Christian university.
Right.
Yale, Princeton, all the Ivy League schools were Christian universities. They were established that way. They had seminaries in them. And now you couldn't even utter a prayer in the halls of Harvard. Or could you imagine trying to do that in class? Look at how far we've come. I mean, that was never the intent. It's always based on this separation of church and state, which is not what they meant.
Which is not in the Constitution. That is just a separation of church and state is part of a letter. It's not
now, that's a good point. It really isn't even in the Constitution.
It's not in the
letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote.
Right. And there
his
was
intent wasn't to keep the church out of the school. Scientists worship theories, he said, and engineers are practical and they design things. Do you agree with Dr. Marks?
He's
kind of right about those theories, I think. I think he's right in the fact that scientist, what he means, academic scientist.
Okay.
That's what he's talking about, and I agree with him, because they get a theory, and they just talk about that theory all the time and worship it. That's true, whether it's physiology or chemistry or whatever, a mechanism, and they don't necessarily do anything with it. I think that's where he's saying engineers or practical scientists that actually build things and do things.
So,
I mean, you're really more of a...
I'm a
practical... You know, you're not sitting in an Ivy Tower somewhere talking about something.
I'm a practical scientist.
He talked about his modeling, and he gave great details about his computer programming, and what he tried to do was model evolution and build it. He said there was no working model for it. That's why he did it, because he said, this is a theory, and they talk about, you know, this is probably what happened, it's in all the books, but there's no model for how it would happen, how the information would actually get into the cell, and how it would develop and so forth. In the amount of time that we have. So his modeling, using strictly mathematics and science, showed that there's no way to get there from here. You can't start from molecules and end up with human consciousness and self-reflection and all that we have in the amount of time that we have, you know, since the Big Bang, alone. He's not saying evolution didn't happen. He's certainly not saying microevolution didn't happen, but even macroevolution, he's not saying that. He's saying it alone, as a standalone theory, Darwinian evolution cannot explain what we see.
There is a lot of information inside DNA that we don't know yet.
No, we don't. And that's the problem is he talked about information. He said there's too much specified complex information was the word he used. Specified complexity. He said it's not only complicated or complex, but it's specific. Meaning it had to be this way. It couldn't have been another way. Because if we'd move the bases around, we wouldn't get the same gene to make the protein, etc. And there's a lot of DNA that we don't know what it does.
So
how does that information come about without an information writer?
Right. And then, you know, so I'm sitting there, if you put that onto humans, does that mean that before a person's born, that God had written the information into this person's DNA that says, hey, you're going to be a famous inventor or you're going to be a famous president or whatever before you're even born? Mm. You're just given that information, that technology, that ability before you're born.
How much of our destiny is decided by our DNA, by our genetics, before we ever even come out of the uterus.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's possible. You know, we don't, I mean, there's certainly, we know that part of it is destined, for sure. I mean, there's no question about it. So we don't know the whole story, but we do know that DNA is a miraculous molecule, and it does contain information that is complex and specific. And according to Dr. Marks and his work, it couldn't have come about by accident. It couldn't have come about without the input of intelligence. I think that's his main point. You can't get intelligence without putting in intelligence. You can't get consciousness without consciousness. It, you know, you can take matter and develop into lots of things, but it can't become conscious and aware and talking and language and all this from just molecules. In other words, it started with consciousness, with God. We got matter, and then it developed into what it reflects, where it came from. So that's the big picture message here. But I enjoyed this interview.
All right. This guy was before really good. Before we finish up, we got to do a shout out to certainly one of our biggest and our oldest fan is Gretchen and her brother.
Yeah.
And also the University of Kentucky.
Yeah, we got students at UK. Who've been listening to the show, and we want to say thanks for your support. We hope you enjoy the shows. We'll keep them coming.
Totally. We're excited. Blew us away. Yeah.
We're excited that you're interested in faith and science and the interface of the two.
Definitely, like us on iTunes.
Yeah, go on to iTunes. Anybody out there.
Make comments.
Please go on to iTunes. Click that you like the show, even if you don't like it. just say something, you know? Absolutely. We love God Talk. We wish we had more time to give to it, but we're always trying. We got a lot of good shows coming up, so stay tuned. This is God Talk, where we faithfully examine science and we reasonably examine faith.
And this is God Talk, the one-stop audio companion for the curious Christian, the seeking scientist, the dangerous deacon, or the angry atheist. God Talk gives real answers to challenging questions. Thank you for listening. God seemed to speak now.